Idag är ingen mindre än journalisten och författarinnan Tara Kangaroo. Nej. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Förlåt, man vet ju inte hur du uttalas, Tara.
It's perfect.
Okej, okay. It's perfect. Hon är även professor på Georgetown University i Washington. Välkommen hit. Welcome to my show.
Thanks so much, Bettina. It's so good to be with you and your listeners.
I can't say your last name. Can you please spell it for me?
It's okay. It's Kangaroo, Kangaroo. I think the Brits, of all the foreigners, say it the best, Kangaroo.
Kangaroo.
But it's been something that all of my colleagues throughout the years on television, radio, you know, they all had problems with. So no problem.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
We're going to take this interview in English because Tara is an American citizen. But Tara, tell me, you have Persian roots. You're from Iran. So tell me about yourself.
I was born and raised in Iran until I was in my late teens, and that's when I moved to the United States. My parents actually were in the U.S. back in the 60s, Bettina, way before the revolution happened in 1979. And, you know, I was born with an American passport, so I had the good fortune of being able to, you know, leave Iran whenever I wanted. And that's what I did when I was about to finish high school. And then I went to the U.S. In California, in Southern California, went to university and graduate school and started my professional career as an American journalist. But of course, because I was born and raised in Iran, you know, Iran was home. I always call Iran my mother. And, you know, it's always stayed part of my life. And I was always traveling to Iran until I was, you know, fully then immersed in my work as a journalist, because, as you know, it's been challenging. So we can get into that. But I was always back and forth until I was 24. And yeah, I never gave up my roots. So I consider myself, you know, as Iranian as I'm American, I guess.
And how old were you, did you say, when you came to the States?
I was 17. When I left Iran for the U.S., I was 17 years old. But my father, who was a very well-respected surgeon, he was in Iran and, you know, he stayed there. And so every summer, every excuse I could get, I would travel to Iran. You know, even if it was a week in spring break, I was in Tehran. But all the summers I would spend back home. And then my father passed away in 2011. And so that was the last year that I sort of spent majority of my time there. And 2012 was when I started to work for Wolf Blitzer and CNN in DC. And so that's really when I became very involved in covering the Middle East and so forth. And I didn't go back to Iran until 2015. I was at Al Jazeera America at the time, and I took my team to Iran to cover the then nuclear deal. And so that was sort of the first time I went back, you know, as an American journalist. And it was quite an interesting experience. But you know, I often say, Bettina, I gave up my ability to go back to my home country because of my work as a reporter. reporter because I believed in this craft and because I believed in you know, what journalism can do. And, you know, that was my sacrifice. Obviously, I paid a big price, but you know, I definitely miss the opportunity to go back home.
It's very difficult for many Persian people to enter the States, especially after World Trade Center and the things, what happens in the U.S., and especially with the relation between U.S. and Iran. How come it was so easy for you, your family, to enter the U.S.? I mean, you didn't come in the 60s. You come when you were 17 years old.
Yes. Well, I was an American citizen. I was, I, like I said, you know, I had my American citizenship, but my parents were green card holders. You know, that generation, obviously during the Shah, they had a much easier time to get into the U.S. My parents, you know, like I said, they had their citizenship, but what you mentioned about Iranians having a hard time coming to the U.S., especially after 9/11, and of course, especially even after the revolution, and to an extent, some periods it has gotten worse. And some periods it was, you know, I guess less horrific of an ordeal, but it was always a challenge, okay, for Iranian people inside Iran to get a visa, even if it's a tourist visa. And that's a very big conversation. But of course, as you know, the Trump travel ban, even, you know, in many cases worsened the situation. You know, the sort of blanket ban that he put over certain countries, including Iran. And so, you know, people of Iran, unfortunately, have always been the victim of the policies of their own government, but also that of the United States. And because of the feud between the two regimes and countries and governments, the people have always been in the middle. So that's quite unfortunate. But one other thing I want to add is that, you know, because of this lack of diplomatic relations between Iran and the United States, people of Iran have not been able to, you know, tell their story. And unfortunately, the American public doesn't really know much about Iran other than what they hear on the news or, you know, through a political lens. So all of this really contributes to all to the many hardships that Iranian people face in this process of, I guess, traveling to the U.S., as well as other, of course, issues.
I mean, like you said, coming from Iran, and your father is working as a surgeon there, and coming to the States, become an American journalist, it's like doing something bad against your own home country. It's like, are you now working for the enemies? I can imagine that that the Iranian feels like that. I mean, wasn't you worried about what they can do with your father in Iran, or you never thought about the consequences about being a journalist with the enemy, the state of the U.S.?
That's a great question. Yes, exactly. And that's a great question. So my father, like I said, passed in 2011, right? And I was in graduate school in 2010 studying journalism. And I remember, actually, I was working at NBC in Los Angeles starting 2010. I was still in graduate school, but that was my first job with NBC. And I was with them for 2 years, right? So when Dad passed in 2011, and I went to Iran that summer, I was so nervous, you know, I was so nervous about, oh my God, you know, would they know that I work for NBC? And stuff. But, you know, I was so junior, and I, you know, I didn't have a profile whatsoever. And, you know, that didn't become an issue, right? But then when I became a public figure, and I became, you know, recognized and well known and established in the field, because, by the way, Bathina, there's so few of us, you know, in the United States. There are very few Iranian journalists, you know. And also, by the way, I've always been proud of my heritage, okay? And we can definitely talk about that. So I didn't conceal my Iranian identity to become this American journalist. You know, I always was proud of where I came from and, you know, my identity. But anyway, so when I, you know, really became known, I think that was when I obviously realized that, you know what, it's not going to be safe for me to go back. But of course, you know, I sacrificed, again, my ability to go back to my home country. You know, my dad is buried there. We still have a home there. It's a dream of mine to travel there with my husband. But of course, unfortunately, the government of Iran is not welcoming of foreign press. And so it's not wise for me to go back. But again, in 2015, we went back with my team, and that was obviously through, all the right channels. But yeah, you know, I gave up that ability, and that's a sacrifice I made for this profession. But what I would say is that the Iranian people are always proud to see fellow Iranians in whatever field it is. You know, that's a public field, whether it's in, you know, science and medicine and media. So I always get very positive feedback and love and support from the Iranian people, both, you know, in US, you know, outside of Iran, and also inside. But of course, the Iranian government doesn't have a good relationship with journalists.
Do you think,
especially, you know, from the US?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Do you think it's worth it?
I don't know. That's such a powerful question. You know what? I'm proud of everything I've done, okay? And I'm proud of the path I chose. But when I see the world around me, okay, whether it's a situation in Iran or Syria and, you know, Afghanistan, whatever country I covered, okay, it makes me sad because, you know, every single story I did, I thought, you know what? Something's going to change, something's going to get better, but then you're left with the reality that, you know what, the world has a strange way of you know, keeping those who are not necessarily righteous in the power, and the people continue to suffer. So That hurts me, you know, especially in the case of Iran. In fact, it's funny because I'm working on a piece it's titled, you know, The Trauma of Covering Iran as an Iranian-American Journalist. But was it worth it? Yes. Am I proud of it? Yes. Did I make a difference? I hope so. Do you know what I mean? I hope so. Because otherwise, I would be cynical and jaded, and I don't want to be that person.
Tara, I mean, you've been working as a journalist on the ground. I mean, you've been working in Syria, in Iraq. You've been now, for the last year, working with the rights for the Persian Iranian girls of Iran. I don't know if I want to call it a revolution, but there's something. People are not satisfied with, especially the women of Iran, the democracy. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's democracy they are searching for, but they want their rights. And I know that
absolutely.
I know you've been talking a lot of that for the last year. And now it's one year of that, I will call it revolution thing. And but before that, you've been to Syria, you've been to Iraq. You've seen the wars between the civil wars in Syria. You've been following the Arabic Spring. Can you tell me, because in Sweden we only see one side of the story, the Western world, and especially Sweden, we don't see our own involvement in these wars. We just see refugees coming to this place, and we think we received too many refugees. At the same time, we can't see how we can stop the war before it becomes a war. And unfortunately, we are so much involved, the Western world in general, and I think it's very, very hard and difficult for a Swede to see the situation from a helicopter perspective. And can you please explain to me how it really is? Because you've been there on the ground in these wars.
Yes. So I just to give some background for the listeners, you know, I've spent a lot of time in Lebanon and Jordan and southern Turkey, especially covering the war in Syria and Iraq and the rise and fall of ISIS, and you know, even the terrorism in Europe and the terrorist attacks and so on. So I know the issue front and back, and also the influx of refugees, you know, from the Middle East to Europe. You know what I would say, Bathina, a few things. Number one, unfortunately, the Western world has dehumanized the people of the Middle East, okay? And that means that for the public, whether it's, you know, in Sweden and, you know, elsewhere in Europe or the UK or the United States, people of Middle East have only been defined through very narrow narratives. Okay, whether it's religion, Islam, you know, terrorism, dictatorship, and so on. And that is the only narrative that the majority of the public thinks when they think of, you know, these countries that we're talking about. Okay, and of course, there are, you know, educated and intelligent people out there, including, you know, your listeners, who can distinguish. But this the dominant narrative of the Western world toward the Middle East has often been this sort of, you know, superior versus inferior, or that we're going to come save you and we're going to come rescue you, right? I mean, look at Afghanistan right now. Look at Iraq. I mean, I think Afghanistan honestly is just a disaster if you look at what has happened, right? And so that begs the question. This is the second point I want to make in answering your question. That is, the people. My focus as a journalist and storyteller has always been on the people, okay, and the humanity that's at stake in this ability to tell stories of people from the vantage point of those being affected by whatever crisis it is that they're being affected on, and therefore this opportunity to connect them to the people of the West, right? You know, whether it's the US or UK or elsewhere. So my mission has always been to tell stories of ordinary people on the ground so that my audience outside, who again knows nothing about these people, can understand them a little bit more, can see them beyond these political narratives, can connect with them, can develop empathy, and can define them for who they are. Okay, and so I think that's where we can improve on. Okay, as independent journalists and storyteller, or those within the media landscape. But then again, the other point that I want to emphasize on, unfortunately, you know, the mass media space right now is about clickability, viewership, and so on. And you know, in-depth storytelling really doesn't get the clicks, if you so will. And on top of that, policy-wise, again, that's going to be a long discussion. I'm sure we don't have time for that. But again, you and I both know, Bathina, that countries don't have friends, okay? Countries have interests. And so I think people, again, whether in Sweden or UK or US, I think they should realize that, you know, there's a huge difference between the policies that their government is making toward whatever country then, you know, the reality on the ground. And I encourage them to educate themselves. And one of the best ways to educate one is to know about the people, okay? The people on the ground and their stories, talking to locals. And if you, you know, don't have a local, you can't go, you know, to Syria or Iraq or Lebanon, you know, if in your community, don't be afraid of immigrants. Don't be afraid of people who don't necessarily think like you. Educate yourself. To talk to them, learn from them, and see if you can, you know, listen to one another. I think that's so important. And that's when the power of people will become then more powerful than the state. And that's really why I wrote my book, The Heartbeat of Iran. You mentioned the anniversary of the uprisings in Iran in the aftermath of the Mahsa Jina Amini killing last year on September 16, you know, I always cared about people, and I wanted to tell the Iranian people's story and stories, and that's why I did my book. So that's another example of how I thought I can contribute in this narrative building. I hope I answered your question.
Yes and no, because the thing is that, like I told you, that the Western world, the people, I'm talking about the people, you're saying, they're interest from the U.S., like, why didn't we bomb Saudi Arabia? Because there's oil there and they needed their oil and everything. It's not about if you're Christian or Muslim. Even in Syria, you know, they're involved in this war. They was one of the countries who really created the war in Syria. And everybody's talking about the war in Syria, that it was a civil war and it was all about the president, Bashar al-Assad. But nobody was really seeing what was happening behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And when we read our newspapers in Sweden, it's all about talking about the dictator. But nobody's talking about the interests of the Western world. Nobody's talking about why they are involved with the war. They just talk about it like Russia is the enemy of the world and the U.S. is the savior. And I don't understand sometimes why people don't try to find the truth. But maybe it's very hard when you're so overwhelmed with when you read. You really believe in what you're reading. And I mean, you've been working there on ground, and can you understand my frustration?
Yes. I think it's always important to, again, educate yourself beyond what is being fed to you, right? And I always tell my students, for example, you know, if you're reading American news outlets, read European ones, read Middle Eastern ones, because then in those different viewpoints and analyses and reporting, you can see the nuances, right? And educate yourself. Again, it's not about one being better than the other, or, you know, it's about having different viewpoints so that you as a person can have the critical thinking and better judgment, right? But at the same time, again, I just, you know, the narratives that are out there oftentimes are there to serve certain interests. And so that's why, for example, I'm such a fan of independent journalism, you know, public journalism. One of my favorite news outlets in the U.S. that I every morning listen to is NPR, National Public Radio. It's a public service, it's a public radio. And so that's why I think more than ever, independent journalism is super important. And I encourage listeners to pick up a different newspaper that you may not necessarily read, and also read international news sites, Middle Eastern news sites, American news sites, and just, so you know, get a different perspective.
The Swedish people don't know everything about the news in America, but we know about the CNN. We heard a lot about this Trump, Fox News. What is the difference between Fox News and CNN? Can you rely on the news, or is it only fake news?
I think you know, Bettina, that's one of the reasons that I'm not sure if I want to go back to sort of television mainstream, just because I think, again, it goes back to that sort of entertainment aspect of it, right? I started doing journalism as an investigative journalist, right? And I care about long form stories. I care about, in-depth storytelling that unfortunately doesn't necessarily get those clickability, if you so will, you know. And right now, unfortunately, the audiences have, you know, an attention span of 30 seconds, and every day it gets worse. And it's really frustrating, Bettina, because, even, for example, I write regularly for Time magazine, okay? And it would probably take you maybe 5 to 6 minutes to read an article. But I realize people don't read. People honestly don't read. And I saw that so evidently last year when I was, covering the situation in Iran, is that people read a headline and then they move on. And I think that's also not fair. I think people really need to spend time reading. Instagram is not a source of news. Twitter is not a source of news. Information are on there, right? But you have to go to credible journalists, people that you trust and respect, and read.
you've been traveling around in, like you said, Jordan, that's Jordanian and Swedish, and Turkey and Lebanon. When you meet Muslim normal people, do you see them as like ISIS? Like, people are nowadays afraid of Muslim people?
That's a great question, Bettina. I definitely don't, because, you know, I understand that region. I come from that region. I grew up in Iran. If anything, you know, everybody thinks Iranians are, you know, Ayatollahs and backward, you know, uneducated people, unfortunately, and they're defined by the mullahs. And that has always been a frustration for me, right? And that's why I always wanted to focus on telling people's stories and educating my audience on the people of Iran and also people of the Middle East. So naturally, when I travel in the region, you know, I don't look at my counterparts as others. You know, I never look at that. Look at folks on the ground in that case whatsoever. In fact, the contrary. My goal as a journalist has always been to defy those stereotypes. But I'll tell you something funny is that, you know, in the Middle East when I travel, I'm also quite nervous to say that I'm Iranian, because their image of Iranian people is also that of the same as the American people, you know, the mullahs and Ahmadinejad and Khomeini, which is so disappointing. I'm not joking with you. I was having a big conference in Jordan back in May, and I was approached by this woman. She was apparently a journalist. She wasn't working, but you know, she was quite prominent, and she said, "Oh, Tara, have you seen this show Tehran?" And I said, "Yes, where are you going with this?" And she said, "Oh, it's so interesting to see how in Iran they have parties and cars." And I'm thinking in my head, are you kidding me, lady? Are you kidding me? You know, this is a civilization that exceeds millennia, and that, you know, Iranian history should not be defined by the mullahs, nor did it start in 1979. That's why, again, to your question, Bettina, people need to understand the people of whatever country that they're dealing with, whether it's the Muslim world, whether it's, you know, Asian countries, whether it's, you know, wherever, it doesn't matter, wherever it is. And so for me, I always find myself having to correct this image that people have of Iranians in my case. And in Middle East, it's always interesting. It's always interesting because, you know, Iran is very naughty in their involvement in you know, the countries in the region. So, you know, people's view of Iranians is very, very limited.
Yes, I understand that. Yes. Because it's very hard. I mean, how can I tell you? I mean, in Syria and in Turkey and Jordan, you go to Petra in Jordan, you go to Beirut, you heard about Beirut from the 60s. I mean, Syria is one, I mean, Damascus is one of the oldest capital, people coming there as tourists. Mm-hmm. I mean, Iran, I mean, all the Persian people, the Iranian people I know that I've been meeting around the world are very well educated. And,
exactly.
And they're very smart people and very, very open-minded. And
absolutely.
Like, wherever you travel in the world, you see that Persian people are really integrated into the new country they mm-hmm. travel to. So,
yes.
Whatever, they are very integrated. And but Iran as a country, nobody went to Iran. Mm-hmm. If you talk to ordinary people.
Yes.
Oh, I've never been to Iran, but people have been to Turkey. People have traveled to Jordan and to Lebanon.
Yes.
And so that's why I think that people don't know so much about Iran.
Yes, yes. And also, I think the media, yes, yes. But also, I think the media, Bettina, did a poor job, okay? Because if you look at all the films and literature that's out there on Iran, it's all about, you know, terrorism and the mullahs and spy movies and, you know, women being, I don't know, stoned or so on. And my view here, it is very important, is that humanizing the people of a country, okay, doesn't necessarily mean you're normalizing the challenges. Okay, when we focus on telling stories of people of Iran, Syria, Lebanon, whatever it is, we are creating a bridge so that, you know, the people of you know, around the world, elsewhere in the world, would get to know those people through their own stories and not just this sort of, you know, not without my daughter, 300, Argo. I mean, how many stories and books have been written on the hostage crisis? Okay, I mean, that's important. That's an important story. But there are a million other stories worth telling of Iranian people that would then dismantle these very narrow sort of bigoted stereotypes, you see. And of course, and unfortunately, because of the political situation, the Iranian, again, government hasn't been the most welcoming to foreign tourists, Western tourists especially, so that prevents the world to see Iran for themselves to then be able to decide, right? And in lieu of that, I think the more stories and the more literature and films and books has to be out there on real stories, you know, of Iran and Iranian people and you know, the humanity. That's what I want to focus on. This is really the humanity. Because at the end of the day, Batina, the hopes and dreams and fears and aspirations of a 16-year-old kid in Iran is the same as a 16-year-old kid in Syria, as a 16-year-old kid in Sweden, as a 16-year-old kid in Amman or New York. Do you understand what I'm saying? Kids and the young generation, they have the same dreams, they have the same wishes, they have the same hopes. So if we amplify that, trust me, we're going to have a way better, more peaceful world than creating these fears. I think fear has taken the place of empathy. And again, that's something I see in the case of Iran and the entirety of Middle East, both as someone who's from that region, but also as a journalist.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
You have been for the last year. Was it a revolution, or what will you call it?
I mean, to be honest with you, I guess if you want to get theoretical, a revolution is a movement that happens and it has an ending, right? I prefer to call it a movement because it's ongoing, right? But at the same time, the passion and fervor and courage of the Iranian people was nothing short of a revolution that again didn't manage to change the regime as so many hoped. But of course, they are pushing forward. So yes, this movement, this ongoing movement.
Mm-hmm. So this ongoing movement in Iran, with all mm-hmm. the girls that are mm-hmm. demonstrating for a better life, for more democracy, for women.
Yes. Yes.
For women of Iran, you've been. You have been talking a lot in media, and you're supporting this action in Iran. Yes. Aren't you afraid that something is going to happen to you, or you can never visit Iran again because of the passion and all the encouragement and all the power.
Work I've been doing on it.
Yeah,
yes.
And the work
yes.
you've been doing.
You know, again, I like I said earlier, I always knew that the minute I become a public figure as an American journalist, I'm not going to have the opportunity to go back to Iran freely, right? So I know that, and that's a risk that I took on. And so it's my responsibility to continue amplifying the voices of Iranian people, amplifying the courageous voices of Iranian youth, whether, you know, be women or men. That's really the least I can do, Batina, you know, because they are fighting the fight on the front line, and we, in the comfort of our lives in the West, that's the least we can do. That's the least I can do. And again, my focus has always been on the people, telling their stories and really amplifying what they want. Because as you mentioned, it's, you know, it's not just about the hijab. You know, Iranian women didn't go on the street to move their headscarf to be able to wear bikinis or, you know, whatever. It's a categorical frustration with a medieval archaic regime that's preventing everyday Iranian from living life as they see fit for them, that includes all of their rights. Every day people are being oppressed and suppressed for their views and doings. I mean, just the last week we saw a huge purge on some of the top university instructors in Iran. Some of the best university professors have been dismissed and replaced by, honestly, bigots, uneducated people. And so this movement, again, goes beyond just women's rights. It's really about human rights. It's about the rights of the civilians. Batina, Iranians are some of the most educated, some of the most vibrant and able societies in that region. We're talking about 80 million citizens who have so much to contribute, not just to their own country, but to the entire world. And every day they're being held back. They're being held back to dream, to do good, to meet their potentials. And that's quite disheartening. And that's why this movement was so universal. Everybody wants this change. Everyone wants to break free from the chains of this, you know, medieval system that is just holding them back.
Will it happen?
I think one way or another it will, because we saw the youth speak, we saw young people out there, and again, this is a country of 83 million people, and the majority of these people want change. The majority of these people, more than 90% of them, want change. It is only a small percentage of regime supporters who feed on this regime, who want to hold on to power. They're powerful, they have a lot of money, and they're, you know, their influence reaches. But the people are tired, Batina. They're fatigued. They know better. They know their rights. They know what they deserve. And they're educated, sophisticated people. And you can't stop that. So they're an unstoppable force, and they're pushing forward.
And the question is, why didn't the Western world now, when the people really asked for help, never helped the people of Iran? But when the people didn't ask the Western world for help, they like attack and bombed Iraq.
That I think would be for our next episode. But listen, I think.
But
way,
you do understand my question.
Yes. No. Absolutely. And my answer is quite simple but telling, which is, again, governments around the world don't care about the people on the ground. Okay. We have seen that again over and over and over again. The shambles we saw in Afghanistan, the disaster in Syria, Yemen. It doesn't matter, Batina. The governments of the world care about their interests and their interests alone. And I think we as the people should be wiser. And by focusing on understanding and connecting with one another, however way that is, we can move beyond the political game. Because I think, especially in the case of Iran, that was so obvious, you know, that okay. I mean, look at the UN. I mean, it, for example, just quickly, I'm going to mention this. This is fascinating, is that, you know, Iran was kicked out of this, you know, Women's Rights Commission back in, I think, December of last year, early December. And then 6 months later, 9 months later, Iran started chairing the human rights group. I mean, sort of like, are you kidding me? I mean, what is this? So it's sort of, you know, when it comes to tangible change, let me put it this way. When it comes to tangible, real change, the world and global powers have had little impact on the ground, again, in the cases of the countries that we've seen. And then in some cases, they've even made it worse. So that's why I'm hopeful that the people of Iran are going to bring the change that they want. They are wise. They are capable. They are talented beyond words. And they so deserve more. They so deserve more. They share so much values with those in Europe, US, the rest of the Middle East, that if only people of the world get to connect with Iranian people, so much good can come out of that.
I will also talk about the sanction against the Iranian people and against Syria and all of them, making the people starve, and they're thinking they are like destroying for the regimes. But the only way, the only thing they are doing are destroying for people. They have no money to buy even food. So these sanctions, they can drop them from tomorrow or from today. I know that you're in a hurry. You've been writing your book, A Heartbeat.
The second book, yes. The first one is out. People can get it anywhere, which actually makes it so special, because anywhere in the world, you know, the Western world, people can get to meet their Iranian counterparts through the stories in The Heartbeat of Iran. So, yes.
Yes. Don't buy it. The Heartbeat of Iran. And you also, you're working a little bit with charity now also, not just a little bit, but before ending this conversation, I would like you also to just tell me a little bit about.
Sure. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
You're humanitarian.
Humanitarian. Works.
You're humanitarian.
Thank you for mentioning my humanitarian work and Art of Hope. So I launched Art of Hope back in 2016, and that was in the aftermath of covering, again, the war in Syria and Iraq, and spending a lot of time in the border regions in Lebanon and Turkey and Jordan. And so every single story I did, Bettina, I couldn't help but to think about the mental health toll that the war and displacement has had on these families and children. You know, I met a lot of victims of ISIS, and you know, I just couldn't imagine that, you know what, these people are living an incredibly hard life right now. They've been displaced, they left their homes, and they've seen excessive amount of terror that we can't even imagine. So how are they dealing with this loss and trauma? And, you know, I lost my dad, and it took me many years of therapy to deal with that. And so in 2016, I launched Art of Hope in an effort to specifically focus on the mental health support and trauma relief aid for war-torn refugees, IDPs, and vulnerable members of the host community. And since then, we've done a lot of work in Lebanon. As you know, Lebanon is is a small country with the highest number of refugees per capita in the world. And so we did a lot of programming across Lebanon, art therapy, group therapy, and a lot of sort of grassroots trauma relief efforts with the help of local mental health professionals. Okay. And now we have grown with the support of, you know, friends of Art of Hope, and we have operations in Eastern Ukraine and Southern Turkey, Northern Syria. So again, we're a small nonprofit, but every single dollar we raise goes to the ground, to the trauma relief work that we do. And yeah, it's, you know, it's a passion project of mine, because I've dealt with mental health challenges in my personal life, and I've seen it professionally. And I just feel that no child or mother or father or really family has to deal with it, these invisible wounds. You know, they're invisible wounds and scars of war and displacement. So I hope mental health is something that we focus on, both in our lives, but also when it comes to vulnerable communities, and in this case, the refugees.
What do you think we can do as people for making a better world for them to live in?
Bettina, I think that we need to inherently stop looking at others as others, okay? There is no difference between me and a Syrian mother. There is no difference between you and an Iranian mother. The minute we live our lives in the comfort of our you know, homes in Sweden, London, whatever, US, with the knowledge that we are the same, and I'm going to teach my children that we're the same, and caring and bridging cultures through empathy and connecting with these people has to become a way of life. This is not charity. It is not charity that we should care about these people. No, it's a humanity. It's a way of life. So the more we practice this in our daily lives, rather than, oh, we're doing good now, oh, we're doing charity work. No. There's no difference between, you know, me and the Iraqi girl who's my age. I just happened to be born in a different country at a different time, and I was just lucky, right? If she was born in the US, it would be a different thing. So it's a practice of daily life, having empathy and understanding of people's challenges and sufferings should be a way of life, not charity.
There's a lot of right-wing politicians now in Europe, and what can you say to them? Like, you know, burning the Quran, they think it's okay here in Sweden. The some of our politicians, they think it's okay because it's our right of speech. What can you say to them as a journalist?
That hatred is never gonna get anyone anywhere. Dialogue and understanding is the way to move forward. You don't have to agree with your counterpart. You can agree to disagree, but hatred, Bettina, is not gonna go anywhere.
Thank you so much, Tara, for letting me having you as a guest. My English is so bad, especially today. I don't know why. Thank you for letting me having this interview with you. I'm so happy with that.
Thanks so much, Bettina, and thanks so much for having me. And you know what? Next time, I promise that I'm going to improve my Swedish. I mean, after all, my husband is Swedish, so I'm gonna try.
But it's okay when you talk English in Sweden, you don't have to learn Swedish.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm really pleased to have had this opportunity. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.